Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Well, coming up in just a minute, we will meet Clark Kent Irvin, the fearlessly named longtime friend of President Bush, who the president appointed as the first Inspector General of the Homeland Security Department, but then let go after Irvin was asking too many uncomfortable questions about the department and about security in the United States. Clark Kent Irvin in just a minute, but I do want to let you know for just 1 minute that we're off to a good start in our Spring membership drive. Thank you very much to those of you who called in and made a donation or logged on and made a donation last hour. We are now embarking on this annual membership drive, and I invite you to join us. So maybe right now or maybe a little later, you'll take a minute to support WNYC New York Public Radio to help us pay the bills for the next year and to ensure that this program and everything else you might listen to on the station will continue. If you're new to this, it's really simple and straightforward. We ask you, all our regular listeners, to make a once-a-year donation to keep nonprofit news and information radio alive in the New York area. The average pledge in recent years is right around $100. More, if you can afford it, is great. Less is fine. So we will really appreciate it if you do that today on the phone or on the web. And everyone who pledges will be automatically entered in our drawings this weekend to win an iPod Hi-Fi, a video iPod, or a MacBook Pro. So make a tax-deductible contribution at WNYC.org. You'll see how right on the homepage. Or call us 1-888-376-WNYC. That's 1-888-376-9692. And thanks a lot in advance for your pledge during the Brian Lehrer Show in our spring membership drive. Thanks again. Now to Clark Kent Irvin, the first Inspector General of the United States Homeland Security Department, appointed by President Bush, but then not renominated at the end of his recess appointment by the president after he asked a few too many inconvenient questions. You may remember that Clark Kent Irvin was one of the panelists at our recent event at the New School on learning from 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina. So now we'll get to hear him stretch out a little bit and talk about his experiences, his ideas, and his new book called Open Target, Where America is Vulnerable to Attack, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Clark, good morning. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me.
First, let's get past your name, because you know everyone's wondering, and I didn't go there during the panel discussion. Did your parents name you after Superman's secret identity?
Well, actually, my brother named me after Superman. My brother was about 10 or so at the time when I was born, and he knew I was going to be a boy, and he asked my parents whether he could name me after his favorite comic book hero, and they said yes. So both he and they had a sense of humor.
Did you take a lot of ribbing as a kid over this?
I did, but you know, I do it on purpose, really. I could be Clark K. Irvin or just Clark Irvin. I choose to be called Clark Kent Irvin just because I think it's so funny.
Where'd you grow up?
Houston, Texas.
And how long have you known President Bush?
I've known the president since 1988. A mutual friend of ours was talking to me one day, and I told him that I'd love to work in the White House at some point. A former President Bush was running at that point, and he got me in touch with George W. and met him, and he got me a job in his father's administration.
So what has he appointed to you to in your life prior to Inspector General of the Homeland Security Department?
Before being the Homeland Security Inspector General at the beginning of the department in 03, I was the Inspector General at the State Department during Colin Powell's tenure as Secretary of State. So that was my first George W. Bush presidential appointment. Before that, during the 6 years he was governor of Texas, I was appointed and served as Assistant Secretary of State for the first 4 years. And then for the final couple of years, I was a Deputy Attorney General for the then Attorney General John Cornyn, who's now a junior United States Senator from Texas.
Do you consider yourself a personal friend of the president?
Well, I consider myself a friend of the president. You know, personal friends suggest that we're very, very close, you know, a small circle of people. And I don't think that's accurate, but I consider the president a friend. I think he considers me a friend, and I wish him well.
Used to hang out, go to the gym?
No, we're not like that. We're not like that. But the president has a million friends, and I'm one of them.
So there you are, a mild-mannered inspector general for a great metropolitan bureaucracy. And what did you begin to discover that began to make your benefactors at the Homeland Security Department so uncomfortable?
Well, very shortly after I arrived, it became clear to me that, as I say in the book, Open Target, it, the Secretary Ridge and other leaders of the department were more concerned with confronting me than confronting the terrorists. Time after time, my team of investigators and auditors and inspectors would uncover one vulnerability or another, aviation security, port security, et cetera, et cetera. And when I brought these vulnerabilities to the attention of Secretary Ridge and his team and made recommendations as to how to address them, all too often, in fact, invariably, the reaction was either we were making a mountain out of a molehill, or the problem we were pointing to had already been solved. So I think the Secretary was more concerned about the political fallout than he was about actually addressing these vulnerabilities that terrorists could all too easily exploit.
Aviation security, as you say, port security. Visa security is another one you write in the book, very much in the news right now. Were you pressured explicitly or subtly to sugarcoat your findings?
I was. You know, over the course of my nearly two-year tenure, just short of it by a month or so at the department, I had only two substantive meetings with Secretary Ridge. Both of those meetings were ones in which he summoned me to his office, really, ultimately it turned out to try to intimidate or pressure me into either toning down my reports or trying to coordinate their release with his press office so that the best possible spin could be placed on them. And I resisted that pressure because I believed and continue to believe that I had an obligation as Inspector General to tell it straight. It's the American people's government. They have a right to know how well it performs.
Who pressured you? Tom Ridge personally?
Secretary Ridge did. He, on one occasion, said, "Why do you release these reports publicly? Why are you being so damning? Are you my Inspector General?" I had an Inspector General in Pennsylvania when I was governor, and he never did this kind of thing. And my response to that was, "I'm not your Inspector General. I'm the American people's Inspector General, and you and I both work for them."
What is an Inspector General?
I'm glad you asked, because I think it's fair to say most people probably don't know the answer to that. And I confess I didn't really know that much about what Inspectors General do when Colin Powell asked me to be the Inspector General at the State Department. Basically, there are three functions. The first is, as the name implies, Inspectors General inspect the programs and operations of the federal departments for which they have responsibility to determine whether the departments are working as effectively and efficiently and economically as possible. Second, we have a team of auditors who, among other things, go over the books of our various agencies to make sure that money is being properly spent and properly accounted for. And then finally, we have a team of criminal investigators whose job it is to investigate allegations of criminal wrongdoing, and if we substantiate those allegations, we're to refer them to the Justice Department for prosecution.
So it doesn't sound like it's head-on policy-oriented, like you're really supposed to figure out what's wrong with, you know, port security or visa security.
Well, actually, we are supposed to do that. We're not supposed to make policy, but we're supposed to evaluate how effectively the policies are being carried out. Mm-hmm. And so the reports that I did fit into that template.
Did you ever appeal to President Bush directly to support you in your work, given your prior relationship?
I did not. You know, the president, of course, is very, very busy. I was at the sub-cabinet level. It's extraordinary, if not unprecedented, for a sub-cabinet official to have direct access to the president, so I never did. It was my job to go through the secretary, and I tried to do that, and it didn't work.
Clark Kent Irvin, my guest on WNYC, the first Inspector General of the U.S. Homeland Security Department, not renewed after his recess appointment expired, and he would have had to be put before the Senate for confirmation. His new book is called Open Target, Where America is Vulnerable to Attack, published by Palgrave Macmillan. We can take phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. One of the areas that you write about is port security, very much in the news recently, obviously, with the Dubai Ports World deal. What were you reporting about port security before all that?
Well, a number of things. For example, as you'll recall, Brian, ABC News reported on the first anniversary of 9/11, September 11, 2002, that they were able to successfully smuggle a shipment of depleted, not weapons-grade, but depleted uranium from a port in Turkey, I believe it was, to the port of New York. Then on the second anniversary of 9/11, they were able to smuggle undetected the very same shipment of depleted uranium from the port of Jakarta, Indonesia, to the port of Los Angeles. When we were asked by Congress to investigate exactly how that was done, and we confirmed that it was done and the vulnerability that allowed it to be done, and when we pointed this out to the Customs Bureau and the Department of Homeland Security, their response was, "Hey, this is a good news story. We targeted that shipment for inspection. those shipments for inspection. We inspected them. Our response was, yeah, but you didn't detect the uranium. And if that had been deadly uranium, it could have killed a lot of people. So that was really kind of symptomatic of the response we got time and again when we pointed out flaws in Homeland Security.
And what did you think of the Dubai Ports World Deal and the politics that came to surround it?
Well, I deplore the politics of it. There were some people who were opposed to the deal for political reasons, I think it's fair to say. But I, too, was an opponent of the deal, a vigorous opponent of the deal, not for political reasons, but because I think that in this age of terrorism, this post-9/11 era, we shouldn't allow countries that have ties to terrorism to be in charge of critical infrastructure, strategic assets like our ports. And it's a myth that had that deal gone forward, the Dubai ports world wouldn't have had anything to do with port security. Yes, it's true that the customs would continue to have done inspections and the Coast Guard would have continued to be in charge of port security as proponents of the deal maintain. But what does that mean? You know, we inspect only about 6% of incoming cargo containers. So we don't inspect very much. And further, sure, Coast Guard's in charge of port security, but all that means is the Coast Guard promulgates security standards. Whether those standards are complied with is left up to port terminal operators.
So we should be spending a lot more money on inspecting cargo?
Absolutely. In fact, I have called for 100% inspection of incoming cargo for radiation, you know, the greatest threat. And to those who say that it's unduly expensive or that it's technologically infeasible, I point to the Port of Hong Kong. The Port of Hong Kong is the world's busiest port, and they do it right now as we speak. And if Hong Kong can do it, the United States can't. It's not a failure of money or technology. It's a failure of political will.
Back to politics for a minute. You were originally given a recess appointment, that is when Congress was out of session, so you didn't need Senate confirmation like with John Bolton, the UN ambassador. Is that because you were seen as controversial like him?
Well, I'm glad you got back to that because, you know, it's really a bad news story at both ends of Pennsylvania. You're right. The White House did not renew my – did not resubmit my nomination in 05. But there would have been no need for a recess appointment on the White House's part if Senator Collins, the chairman of the Senate Homeland Security Committee, and her Democratic counterpart, the ranking Democrat, Senator Lieberman, had permitted the full committee to vote on my nomination in 03 or 04. They bottled my nomination up for 650 days. And that was ironic to me for a number of reasons. Most importantly, you would think if there are two members of the Senate who would have the most interest in having a strong, vigorous inspector general with regard to Homeland Security, it would be they, but it's they who held up my confirmation. It's they who are responsible for my not being at the Department of Homeland Security today.
Why Lieberman, do you think? I mean, he seems very national security minded, and not being a Republican, he could have more easily spoken up for you and not worried about bucking the president.
You're absolutely right, Brian. I scratch my head over it. Senator Lieberman, a couple things. One, you know, he's a centrist Democrat. I'm a moderate Republican, so there's very little difference between our politics, so there's no political reason to oppose me. Secondly, you know, you may know him personally. I've heard that he's incredibly gracious and easy to deal with. So of all people, I'm really surprised that he would have treated me this way. Indeed, Senator Collins at least gave me the courtesy of a meeting. It was 10 minutes long, and she didn't allow me to answer any questions. But Senator Lieberman never met with me, even though I asked Secretary Powell to ask him to do so.
Let's take a phone call. Bob on Staten Island. You're on WNYC with Clark Kent Irvin, former Inspector General of the Homeland Security Department.
My question is in regards to some political news they've been making in New York, that they're making the dollar amount Homeland Security is spending on New York as opposed to Wyoming per citizen, or lately I also heard one in regards to Puerto Rico. Do you think the dollars that are well spent in Wyoming and Puerto Rico?
Well, no. I am a big proponent of what the 9/11 Commission recommended, and that is 100% risk-based funding of Homeland Security programs, which is to say, you know, even though we're the wealthiest country in the world, we're in dire fiscal straits. We can't afford everything, so we have to make some hard choices, even when it comes to something as elemental as Homeland Security. And that being so, we have to concentrate our limited Homeland Security dollars on those sectors and sites and those states and cities that are most at risk. And there's no question but that New York remains at the tip top of the terrorists' wish list, while Wyoming, relatively speaking, is much less likely to be attacked.
Yaakov in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC.
Good morning. You guys just mentioned the 9/11 Commission, and those recommendations are mere recommendations. My question is there a way to make them more binding on the president and the administration?
Well, there's no way to make them binding in a legal sense. The 9/11 Commission could not legally bind the administration of Congress. You know, the only effect that they could have is a moral effect. And unfortunately, even though the 9/11 Commission had tremendous moral weight, I would argue, particularly with the support of the 9/11 families, you're quite right to imply that many of those recommendations remain unimplemented to this day. The question is whether it'll take another attack before we take the steps that the 9/11 Commission and that I recommend in my book Open Target to protect ourselves. And the hope, of course, is that it won't take another attack. I'm afraid to say the experience to date suggests that it might well. The hope is that if American people read this book, they'll be so alarmed and so frightened that they'll put pressure on their leaders to implement these recommendations so that we can make ourselves safer.
When we come back, I want to ask you about the fear that your title might actually generate, not to mention the information that it might advertently or inadvertently give out. It's called Open Target, Where America is Vulnerable to Attack. Clark Kent Irvin was the first Inspector General of the Homeland Security Department. We'll take more phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we continue now with Clark Kent Irvin, the first Inspector General of the United States Homeland Security Department, appointed by President Bush, but then not renominated by the president after he asked a few too many inconvenient questions. You may remember that Clark Kent Irvin was one of the panelists at our recent event at the New School on learning from 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina. Now we're getting to hear him stretch out a little and talk about his experiences, his ideas, and his new book, Open Target, Where America is Vulnerable to Attack, published by Palgrave Macmillan. And we'll go to some of your phone calls in just a minute for Clark Kent Irvin. But Clark, can I ask you about the title? You know, a colleague of mine here at the station yesterday, hearing the title of your book, Open Target, Where America is Vulnerable to Attack, exclaimed, "Where America is Vulnerable to Attack, why would someone write a book to tell the enemy where we're vulnerable to attack?"
I think it's a good question, Brian, but the answer is I'm not telling the enemy anything the enemy doesn't already know. The terrorists know everything that's contained in that book about our vulnerabilities. It's the American people who don't know how much peril we're in. And in part, that's because our leaders have misled them into thinking that we're safer than we are. It's as if the leaders think that all it takes to secure the homeland is a department called Homeland Security. So my hope is that once people buy that book, that they will be so alarmed by how vulnerable we are and so outraged that these easy steps have not yet been taken that they'll put pressure on our leaders and the administration and the Department of Congress to take these steps so that we can make ourselves as safe as we can be before the next terror attack comes.
But there, you say the enemy knows, but there are details in here that certainly I didn't know. I'm not planning for a terrorist attack, but you know, you were just an example from before. You were talking about the exact percentage of cargo that is screened as it enters the ports, as compared with Hong Kong.
Right.
Well, maybe al-Qaeda didn't know that until this became widely publicized.
Oh, no. Al-Qaeda knows that the fact that only 6% of incoming cargo containers are inspected is really widely known among the experts, among the cognoscenti, and among the terrorists who work overtime to figure out what the vulnerabilities are to exploit them. And that's what I talk about it toward the end of the book, you know, this vulnerability gap. The reason we're in as much danger as we're in is there's this gap between terrorists' resolve to attack us and our resolve to protect ourselves on the part of our leaders. They're working overtime to exploit these vulnerabilities, and our leaders are dragging their feet on addressing them. For just one quick example, if I may, just last week, as you may know, Secretary Chertoff announced that we're going to start checking the names of port workers against the terrorist watch list. Well, that's a great idea, but why are we doing that now, 5 years after 9/11, 3.5 years after the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, and 1.5 years after Secretary Chertoff took office? That shows that we're not taking the threat as seriously as the terrorists are.
All right. Now we're going to take some phone calls for Mr. Irvin at 212-433-WNYC. That's our on-air number. We will never ask you to pledge while you're on the air. We keep this entirely separate with a strong firewall. So if you want to talk on the air to Clark Kent Irvin, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Jules in Great Neck, you're on WNYC. Hello, Jules.
Hello. Good morning. I wanted to ask Mr. Irvin if he has any comment on the appointment of the Assistant Secretary of Homeland Security for Enforcement. I just know what I read in the papers, but I've read that while this woman may be brilliant, she's a 32-year-old young woman, a lawyer for 6 years, has served in a law firm and in two or three government departments. And
so you wonder if she's too young and unqualified. Do you know who he's talking about?
I do. Actually, the position
What's
is
her
that
name?
Her name is Julie Meyer. She's 36 years old,
okay.
I think. And she is the head of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Bureau of the department, among other. It's a very important agency. It's the second largest law enforcement agency in the federal government after the FBI. And their job is to track down criminals and terrorists among our illegal alien population. At least that's one of their chief jobs. I question in my book, Open Target, whether her appointment was done on the merits. You know, she is the niece of former Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff Richard Myers, and she's married to Secretary Chertoff's Chief of Staff, as I understand it. And as you say, her experience in the field of law enforcement is rather limited indeed. But I think it points up the larger problem. One of the reasons, there are two or three reasons, and I hope we get to this, Brian, why I think the department's been a failure. One of the main ones is this kind of thing, appointing people to senior positions in the department who, with all due respect to them as people, as human beings, lack the experience and the expertise it takes to run what I argue is the most complex, not just the third largest government agency, but really the most complex one, all things considered.
Who's got the expertise?
Well, to be fair, I mean, it's tough. On the one hand, I called a New York Times interview for somebody who's got the managerial skills of a Jack Welch or a Lee Iacocca on the one hand, and the political skills are really the greatest politicians that we have. It's tough to find somebody like that. But, you know, you have to look at somebody like Rudy Giuliani, I must say, who rose to such heights in 9/11. That's the kind of leadership we need at the Department of Homeland Security, not politicians and not lawyers who lack management expertise.
You had your problems under Tom Ridge. Is Michael Chertoff an improvement?
You know, I thought he was going to be a huge improvement. He's certainly different from Secretary Ridge. He's brilliant. He's hands-on. He's decisive. You know, all those really great qualities. And also, when he came in office, he said something that made a lot of sense to me, something that I had said beforehand, and that is, look, we can't do everything, so we need to focus on the biggest threats and those threats that, if they were to materialize, would have the biggest impact in terms of death and injury and economic damage. The problem is that template, that strategic construct that you can't argue with, presented itself very nicely in Katrina. Not only was that foreseeable, but it was foreseen, and obviously the impact was catastrophic. And yet, Secretary Chertoff was manifestly unprepared for it. So at the end of the day, I think we're just as bad off now as we were in the Ridge years, I'm sad to say.
I think Miriam and Merrick wants to follow up on that. Miriam, you're on WNYC.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call. It's been exceptionally interesting. What my question is about Mr. Chertoff, I mean, most Americans felt that he was the most unqualified person to get the job. This is what we all felt. I mean, I could tell you that. I mean, you know, we talk among ourselves. I think there's millions of people who felt like I did.
Well, you know, I don't know if people knew Michael Chertoff beforehand.
Well, I knew of him. I mean, he had a, you know, for people who follow government really closely like I do, of course, you know, he came to fame during the Whitewater hearings when he was a counsel for the Senate at the time. And he ran the Criminal Justice Division at the very beginning of the Bush administration and played a major role with regard to criminal investigations and prosecutions after 9/11. He's a brilliant lawyer, but he's not a manager, and that's what you need at the top of the department. People forget, by the way, that the president's first choice to succeed Tom Ridge was Bernie Kerik here in New York. And with all due respect, you know, it took the press only a week or so to discover what the White House personnel office should have discovered even before naming him, namely that he had all these ethical problems. And he was grossly unqualified for this position. And that a person like that could have been thought of in the first place for the White House suggests how unserious they were about this position of Homeland Security Secretary.
Question about port security from Gary in Queens. Gary, you're on WNYC.
Hi. I've often wondered what's been stopping Al-Qaeda, let's say, from penetrating our shoreline, just getting a boat, getting some WMD into our country that way. The shoreline is supposed to be unpatrolled. It's supposed to be our most vulnerable point.
You mean we're talking about spending all this money on screening cargo that comes in on commercial container ships, but they could just get a boat?
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't we screening cargo, pre-screening it, they call it, where they pinpoint where cargo is coming from and screen it there?
Right. Yes, well, I'm glad you raised that. It's a little complicated, but let me try to summarize it as quickly as I can. One of the major programs, you're quite right, that the department touts makes a lot of sense in theory, and that is, look, if we wait to inspect an incoming cargo ship once it gets to one of our ports, it may be too late. So what we need to do is to push our borders out and get as much cargo inspected at the foreign port of origin before it sets sail for the United States. So that's the theory behind the so-called Container Security Initiative. The department has agreements with about 40 ports around the world and growing, representing more than 70% of incoming cargo. The bad news is there was just a recent report from Congressional Investigation Shop, GAO, that said that more than 80% of the time, when we tell foreign port inspectors that we think that particular container should be opened up, we suspect that it's high risk, it may contain a weapon of mass destruction, foreign inspectors refuse to inspect it. They inspect it only 17.5% of the time, less than a fifth of the time, meaning that more than 80% of the time they don't. And yet, the department touts this as a major antidote to the threat of nuclear terrorism. It's just another example of how the department oversells how prepared we are.
Clark Kent Irvin, former Inspector General of the Homeland Security Department, who fell out of favor with the Bush administration after he asked a lot of inconvenient questions. His new book is called Open Target. And another of your areas in the book is visa security, also very much in the news right now, of course, with the immigration debate in full swing. What did you report about visa security before all this?
Well, a number of things, Brian. I don't know quite where to start. One of the things that was most troubling to me is, as you may know, there's a special provision in the law that set up the Department of Homeland Security that mandated stationing what's called visa security officers. These are supposed to be DHS personnel who are trained in counterterrorism, fraud detection, interview techniques, and they were mandated to be in Saudi Arabia to look over the shoulders of State Department officers who continue to be responsible for issuing visas to make sure, God forbid, that more terrorists don't come from Saudi Arabia, that they aren't issued visas to enter the United States. So we gave it a year or so to see how the program was working in practice. And when we got there in 2004, we found that 9 out of 10 of these DHS agents didn't speak Arabic. They weren't trained in counterterrorism or fraud detection techniques, so they weren't adding much value. So this program that was supposed to prevent further visa issuance to terrorists doesn't work very well.
Now, security against terrorists, as you know, is the reason that some people give as the most important for securing the Mexican border, even with a fence, because Mexico is a lot easier for terrorists to sneak into than the U.S. in general. Then they can get from there to here. Is that important to you?
It's very important to me. You know, we are right now, of course, in the midst of a big debate about illegal immigration, but largely that debate is focused on the economic implications of it. You know, the illegal aliens are taking jobs away from Americans. That's the charge. And to some degree, you know, one could argue that that's true. But I see illegal immigration not as an economic issue so much, but I see it as a national security issue now. I'm not worried about the average Mexican who comes across looking for a job. I'm worried about how easy it is for Al-Qaeda to sneak in among the throngs of immigrants seeking economic opportunity in the United States. Now, the former Deputy Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Jim Loy, who was not known during his tenure for being upfront about shortcomings, in his last appearance before Congress, worried aloud about Al-Qaeda's ability to and intention to do just that.
So what would you do to secure the border?
I do a couple. It's really simple, really. We know what we need to do. We need two things. One, we need more personnel. We need more Border Patrol agents on our Mexican border and our Canadian border, point one. But two, of course, you could never have enough people. I mean, we're talking about thousands of miles of border on both north and south. So we need to supplement our personnel, even when we have more of them, with technology. We need unmanned aerial vehicles. We need sensors. We need surveillance cameras. But the problem is we've known that from the beginning, and time after time the department refuses to deploy enough personnel and enough technology and technology that works. The Department of Homeland Security is on its third iteration of such a program now, and there's precious little difference among those three. We lack the political will to solve this problem to the extent it can be solved.
Seema in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Clark Kent Irvin. Hi, Seema.
Hi, thank you. Please excuse my naivete, but what would be the major reasons for the government not to comply with the 9/11 commission?
I think that's a very good question, and of course I'm speculating, but my speculation is this. You know, the 9/11 commission itself said there was intelligence, we now know, indicating the possibility of an attack on 9/11, but our policymakers discounted it because of a failure of imagination. They just couldn't really believe that it was possible for something like this to happen in the United States because it had never happened before. I think we have a similar phenomenon at work here now, 5 years later. That is, because 5 years have passed since the last attack, we're beginning to think that it's impossible for us to be struck again. For us Americans, 5 years is an eternity. Al-Qaeda, on the other hand, thinks in terms of not centuries, but in terms of millennia. So the fact that we haven't been attacked, in a way, of course it's a good news story, but in a way it's a bad news story, because to me it suggests they are working to make the next attack more spectacular than the last one, and it takes a long time to plan spectacular attacks.
But why would the president not be taking as seriously any of these things you say he's not taking seriously enough? I mean, this is what he's built his whole administration, his whole reputation and legacy on, that he's a wartime president.
That's right.
And he's going to protect the United States.
And I think the reason for that is the president and other people in the Congress think that the war is confined overseas. You know, you often hear the president say, look, particularly with regard to Iraq, we need to be on the hunt and stay on the hunt, because unless we kill or capture them over there, they're going to come over here. Now, he's right. To some degree, we need to kill and capture as many terrorists overseas as possible before they come here. Problem is, there's some terrorists here, one, and it's easy for still more of them to come here. And the problem is that after 9/11, America itself has become a battlefield in the war on terror. It's the most important battlefield, and among battlefields, it's the one that's least protected.
We have a few minutes left with the former Inspector General of the U.S. Homeland Security Department, Clark Kent Irvin. In the meantime, we hope everybody who's listening will contribute during our spring membership drive. Join us once a year. Our website available at WNYC.org for your once-a-year donation, and the phones available at 1-888-376-WNYC, 1-888-376-9692. Thank you all so much for your support today. And Charlie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, hi, Brian. You know, the retired generals who came out after the war recently and criticized faced very vigorous questioning about why didn't they say something at the time when they were in there to actually affect the policy, and not just now after the fact to sell a book. So I think Mr. Irvin is at least responsible to answer the same question. And could he point to additionally one report that he did, not some investigative journalism by ABC News, but one thing that his department did that came out before he left the government, and of course after the election when Tom Ridge and President Bush could strut around saying what a great job they were doing?
Well, you're not familiar, obviously, with my record, because if you go to the Department of Homeland Security's website, you'll find over 200 reports that I issued during my tenure as Inspector General in 03 and 04 that goes into considerable detail about all these vulnerabilities, just as I do in this book. As Brian said, the reason why I'm not at the Department of Homeland Security now is that I was saying exactly what I'm saying now then when I was the Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General. So your criticism of the generals, I think, is spot on. But your criticism of me, I think, is misplaced.
So do you consider yourself as part of a group of people appointed or retained by the president who then got marginalized when they weren't saying what the boss wanted to hear? You know, Charlie reminds me of this by talking about the generals. I think of General Shinseki.
Yes.
Or, in other areas of government, Richard Clark or Paul Pillar from the CIA, who was the Bush administration's own, you know, point person for Middle East and South Asia intelligence. Those kinds of folks?
Yes, I agree. In fact, I'd refer you to a Washington Post op-ed I wrote about a month ago or so, and I took Admiral Loy, the former Deputy Secretary of the Homeland Security Department, and Paul Bremer to task for just that. There was a recent op-ed that Loy wrote where he said, look, you know, the ports are dangerously vulnerable. We don't have enough inspectors, among other things, he said. Never said anything like that when he was the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security and was in a position to do something about it. Bremer, in his new book, says there were too few troops in Iraq. He didn't do anything about it. He didn't say that when he was the ambassador. So General Shinseki did, and of course he's out. I said this, and I'm out. So you're quite right. One final thing. It's not fair to make that criticism of General Zinni. All along, he said that our policies in Iraq were misplaced, so I would not criticize him in that way, by the way.
20 seconds. Is there a number? We're spending X on Homeland Security now overall, and you would have us spend Y?
I don't have a precise number, but I'll say this. I think it is telling that the budget of the Department of Defense is almost exactly 10 times the budget of the Department of Homeland Security, more than $400 billion versus $40 billion. And as between spending money to protect American interests abroad, which is what the Pentagon does, and spending money to defend the homeland, it seems to me the imbalance should be in favor of defending the homeland.
Clark Kent Irvin, former Inspector General of the Homeland Security Department. His new book is called Open Target, Where America is Vulnerable to Attack, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.